And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
World Drenched, the playoffs are off and running. The Vancouver Canucks are not a part of it, but we're still going strong because there's so much to talk about around this team, and we will touch on the playoffs a little bit later. Yes, I admit, I have been watching. It's been painful watching the Leafs. It's been painful watching the Oilers. Actually, it's been fun every second night, but I've been watching. And how about our boy BG? Like, what's going on with Harmon Dial doing post-game for the Leafs? Is this allowed? Are you responsible for this?
I'm not. No, I didn't. I wasn't asked my opinion. I didn't sign off on it. You know, obviously, if I had been, I would have volunteered to do it myself.
No question. I'm just thinking this has got to be so offensive to you that he was asked and you weren't. You would have said, I'll do it as long as you fly me back and I can catch a Jays game while I'm there.
Yeah, that's true. I would have been the more expensive option. The thing is, look. That was, I mean, what a tough one to do. Leafs report cards for that game. No one played well. Pretty easy assignment for Harmon. Just F's across the board,
which is good because we like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, you do anyway.
I do.
How the Mariners doing?
I haven't checked in a while. I know they won yesterday, but they were struggling. I know they were at about an 8-game road trip there where it didn't go.
They're sub 500. Anyway,
well, wait a minute. You just pumped their tires last week, saying, "Oh, they're a pretty good team this year." So now you're going to tell me they're crap. Come on.
No. I think they're fine, but they I think they're going to be about 500,
which is good enough to make the major league playoffs. It didn't used to be like that, but now that could get you there. I know they're banged up. I've been reading kind of on the fringes. You know me, I don't dive into it till it matters, and this doesn't matter. Let's start with changes around the Vancouver Canucks.
Yeah,
since we last did our show. So they have made some changes to their amateur scouting department. They let go of 5 members of said department, including Bruce Boudreau's son, and some longtime scouts. Their pro side of their scouting department is still intact. Just what do you make of the changes so far?
Well, you know, I'm sort of two minds. On the one hand, you know, there's certainly some of the guys that ended up losing their jobs, you know, Ted Hampson, Tim Leonard, and like these are extremely loyal, hardworking guys, been around the organization forever. And I heard some belly aching within the industry about it, right? On the other hand, I also heard some criticism within the industry that perhaps the changes hadn't gone far enough, that people were expecting, you know, sort of larger changes, and that based on the department's performance, certainly in the last couple of years under Benning, and granted, they didn't have a ton of pick value, right? But I mean, they're very likely to have got nothing that contributes meaningful NHL games to the club in the 2020 and 2021 draft classes. And that's that's tough. I mean, that leaves you where the Canucks are right now, where there's just not a lot coming that you can sort of count on, you know, where you're like, well, Myron Berg might be a depth player. It's like, oh, my God. So,
well,
you know,
and that brings up a bigger picture discussion, right? Because we've all been enamored with what happened in Abbotsford in April. And as that ended unceremoniously with a 2-game thud, you know, it puts Trent Cull and Ryan Johnson and just the whole process into question. And I think you and I both agree that Ryan Johnson's a very valuable member of this organization, but that becomes part of it. So we'll go through the names real quick. Derek Richard, Tim Lennarden, Brandon Benning, Pat Conacher, Ted Hampson were all let go. Benning and Richard. Benning was the WHL scout. Richard, the Eastern North America scout, were both hired by Jim Benning and John Weisbrod. So again, that's a significant change. And when you go through this, like, this organization simply hasn't developed, right? Like, we can talk about Cole Lind, or we can talk about Jonah Gadjevich, or we can talk about Zach McEwen, who have all, you know, had varying degrees of success in other organizations. Really, McEwen had some. The other two were just kind of in and out of the lineup and weren't significant pieces in San Jose. Jonathan Dolan, of course, has been with the Sharks, and that didn't go well for a number of reasons. But yes, they haven't had pick value. And yes, you know, I've said repeatedly that the top prospects have been fast-tracked into the main organization and didn't get any marinating time in the American Hockey League level. But you've got to get something out of that. You still have to get something out of that. And yeah, when we watch playoffs where Jet Wu is a 12th forward playing defense and Danila Klimovich is sitting in the stands and Jack Rathbone isn't getting enough ice time, like, there's problems there where sometimes the big picture doesn't necessarily get seen. So you've got, you know, the scouting piece falls into all of that, in my opinion. It's all part of the same issue.
It's hard to disagree. And it sort of speaks to why this club needs changes, right? Like wider scale changes. And comes back to that note that Alvin made about scouting reports being filed correctly, right? About the enormity of the task at hand in modernizing this organization. This isn't a situation, I think, where new management has come in and is trying to get their hands around this sort of unwieldy ship of state. They've sort of come in and been like, oh, this is a rebuild, and not a rebuild in terms of the team's process, but in terms of, like, you know, I don't mean they need to tank. Not that type of rebuild. I mean, like, rebuilding, like, nodes of organizational functioning. I mean, I think that's a pretty fundamental task that they're going to be going through here. And, they'll ramp up. I'd expect we'll see some probably not insignificant hirings on the amateur side in time. Whether we see that before the draft or thereafter, I'm not exactly sure. I think we'll see a pro scout added as well. And otherwise, I don't expect that department to be tweaked too significantly yet. Clearly they've found some people they like, right? Like, Todd Harvey is going to stick around.
So what do we make of that? Like, real quick, what do we make of that? They were very complimentary about Todd Harvey. Patrick Alvin was. Mm-hmm. And so were these Alvin and Rutherford's decisions? Was this Todd Harvey's decision? And, you know, what do you make of the fact that they say all these great things about Harvey, but five guys got let go?
I would assume collaborative. I mean, Harvey came into the job in 2020 after Brackett's departure and ran his first draft without a promotion, right? Wasn't officially the director for another 6 months beyond that. And, you know, being the director under Benning and Weisbrod, I do think there was a fair bit of, involvement, right? I mean, they were very involved in the draft process. And I think that's partly what, you know, hastened Brackett's departure from the club. So, you know, I think, overall, when you look at Harvey, the rep within the industry anyway is, like, pretty open-minded, pretty progressive. There's obviously a close relationship too with Scott Walker there. I do think there's regard for him internally. I wasn't shocked that he ended up, maintaining his perch despite the changes. And I would expect that it was a collaborative process. With, you know, Harvey and on the pro side too, Brett Henning's going to remain as director. He was in town for the trade deadline, which, you know, the moment I saw Brett Henning in town for the trade deadline, I thought, oh, okay, I wonder if there's going to be more stability on the pro side than I'd maybe expected. That does seem to be the case. So, you know, I think part of the idea is that And look, here's the other thing. These are the first real dismissals in the Rutherford era, right? John Wall and Chris Gere were dismissed after the day after Rutherford was hired, but before he was in town. He never met them, right? And now you sort of look through the organization, and Brett Henning and Todd Harvey, the two directors of the scouting departments, have sort of been further empowered, right? They've added to the analytics department, and Aiden Fox is expected to at some point be made a director. That's sort of the industry expectation anyway. He's been, you know, pretty involved in a variety of high level items that the club has dealt with since Rutherford took command. So clearly there's a move to see what some of the people that they've found here can do with better support, better direction. And so in Harvey and Brett Henning's case, they remain directors of the department, but clearly the level of oversight and guidance that they're getting, and the way that they're working with people like Alvin and Cammy Granato and Derek Clancy, and Cammy Granato looming sort of largest, I think, in terms of setting strategic direction at the moment anyway, within both of those scouting departments, you know, I think speaks to an approach that's not really scorched earth within the front office, even as the club looks to pretty significantly change direction.
Yeah, you know, they're names that everybody in the world, as far as Canuck fans, aren't going to necessarily resonate with, right? Because, you know, these aren't top of the organization, but you're right. You know, symbolically, these are statement moves, and they're important moves because, again, this organization, you've got to be able to mine something. We understand they've traded away first round picks, but, you know, a lot of organizations get mileage out of second round picks and find one deep in the draft. And, you know, when you look at the Canucks, we've talked about it before. I mean, Nils Höglander, second round pick, Thatcher Demko, second round pick. But other than that, the cupboard's been pretty bare in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's partly too, because the club just hasn't made enough picks, right? I mean, it's hard to divorce pick value from outcomes, right? Who's the best drafting team in the league? Well, it's the team that makes the most picks as a general rule. You know, I'd bet you that over the last 2 years, what's the team that had the most success? It's going to be Carolina or Ottawa because they took the most swings. Volume matters. And, you know, the Canucks haven't shot at a high enough volume at the draft. And you know, I wonder how much that'll change. Like, you look through this year, they don't have their second round pick. And I wouldn't be shocked if they try to find ways to add picks to their arsenal for this draft year. I would be far from shocked. I would expect the Canucks will run at a draft surplus the next 2 years, which, you know, will take some doing considering that they're down one, right? They only have 13 of 14 at the moment. And yet I would bet 2022, 2023, the club will make more than 14 picks at the draft. That's like a prediction for me. So I do think you're going to see a different orientation there. And that's going to matter a lot more, to be totally honest with you, than, you know, who's your Western area scout, right? Like, you need kicks at the can. You need kicks at the can, and you need a contemporary approach. So, you know, we'll sort of see where this goes, but there feels like there's a lot happening behind the scenes right now. Scouting changes, the Boudreaux thing remains sort of hanging over the club at the moment. I think this week's a really pivotal week, just to shift gears a little. I think if this has a happy ending for those Canucks fans who want to chant Bruce, there it is, as a sign off during wins next year, I think this is a really crucial week for that. The longer this drags on, the more I begin to think that Boudreaux's gonna depart. Put it that way. I feel like if it's put to bed this week, that would be a very good sign, obviously, in terms of the Canucks keeping Boudreaux. Now, a lot of people reading a lot into the fact that Boudreaux was part of Kuzmenko interviews, Andrei Kuzmenko interviews, as Elliot Friedman reported over the weekend.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
Well, he was also at the AHL game, the Hershey Bears versus Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins AHL playoff game. Now, he lives in Hershey, goes to games all the time, you know, big hockey nerd. So not a huge shocker there. But I mean, is there a world where he's involved with the Canucks in terms of planning for next season, but still departs ultimately because of how it all went down?
If you're sitting there in that meeting with Kuzmenko and his agent, Dan Milstein, like, what do you say when they ask you if you're going to be back?
Well, you say yes, but, you know, I mean, you're a football guy. what's said during recruiting
well, there is
always
that.
Always needs to be taken with a grain of salt, right? I mean, more lies get told on July 1st than in any other day on the hockey calendar. We all know this, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you say yes, but can you take that to the bank? I wouldn't.
Well, let's stay on Boudreaux for a second. I want to get into Kuzmenko a little more after the break.
I just want to note, I still think Boudreaux's more likely, like, if I had to bet, and I wouldn't bet with any confidence, because I do think this one's up in the air.
Wow, that's not like you. You bet a lot.
I wouldn't bet with a lot of confidence, but I would bet that Boudreaux returns. I just, you know, the fact that it's lingering certainly has my eyebrows furrowed.
And the reason it's lingering is simply he's waiting to see what other options come open, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I mean, one would think that the way that it went down with that presser makes it a tougher decision, right?
No question. I mean, because certainly at his press conference, he seemed to think they were moving forward with an extension and that it was going to get done. And then the next day, the conversation was completely different. So I don't know if it's taken him a while to get over that. But, you know, the Vegas situation, he'd have to have a sense of where that's going already. The Philly situation, he'd have to have a sense of where that's going already, right? I mean, you know, like, think of how he got hired here. Those conversations began before Travis Green got let go. His agent's pretty savvy and aggressive. You'd have to think those conversations have already been had to a point to get an indication if those options are going to be there. Obviously, you don't know about the Toronto situation, but there are some that you've got, you know, even today, right? The Islanders parted ways with Barry Trotz. And
yeah, so what's up with that?
I know, for sure. I agree with you.
Ridiculous.
At the same time, again, clarity is coming as far as Bruce Boudreaux is concerned.
Yeah.
So
yeah, what's he waiting coming.
On? What's he waiting on?
I mean, that he's got the contractual right to wait till June 1st. I'm sure the club doesn't love that, but he's got that right if he wants to see what shakes loose. But I mean, if you're waiting, you're soliciting other offers, or you're interested in hearing what else is out there, period, right? I mean, there's no other explanation that makes a ton of sense. So I think we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, the Kuzmenko detail is a crucial one if you're hopeful that Bruce returns, right? The Kuzmenko detail certainly seems to point in the direction that Boudreaux's been part of a pitch to a really interesting, really intriguing player. We'll get into this on the other side. But, you know, a player that could really help, potentially, this team. And so the fact that he was part of that recruiting pitch, you know, I do think points in a certain direction. And yet, you know, the sense I had late last week was that there was frustration on both sides and that this one was very much up in the air. And then the sense I had over the weekend was, hey, maybe there's more here. And I wonder if you can sort of square that with, you know, while it remains up in the air, the relationship's good enough that Boudreaux's still part of the planning process. And yet, you know, until it's done, until he decides that, in fact, he wants to come back, you know, under the firm terms that Rutherford's enumerated, which is no extension, you know, until that's sort of announced, I do think there's going to be some doubt, and certainly in my mind, about which way this is going to go.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So we've still got 3 weeks to go, Drancer, as far as Bruce Boudreaux is concerned. Do you expect him to take the entire 3 weeks? Because as you said, this next week, many people believe this situation is going to come to a head, that it's a critical week in the process. Do you think we know a week from now who the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks is, or at least whether or not it's going to be Bruce Boudreau, or is it going to take another couple weeks beyond that?
I mean, I think if it's more like, I don't want to gauge the timeline so much as suggest this. If we don't know this week, then my confidence in Boudreau returning diminishes significantly. Like, I would peg it as more likely than not today. If it doesn't happen this week, I will probably be just on the other side of 50% when we record next Monday. Like, that's sort of how I'm viewing it. The longer it drags out, the more convinced I become that Boudreau's interested in seeing what's out there.
Yeah, and again, I mean, in terms of the plum jobs for him, you have to believe there's been some clarity on at least a couple of them. So, you know, we'll see what happens with the Leafs, and if they lose and Harmon covers it objectively and we find out how bad they are. And we have you in a bad way once we get to this VanCast next week after they lose in six. Maybe it changes. But as far as I'm concerned,
hey, it's coin flip hockey, man. It is.
I know. I'm just messing with you.
Hey, what do you think? Do you think having crowds, like in the NBA, I feel like we're seeing the home teams just win a ton more than I'd have expected based on team quality. And they're not just winning, they're blowouts. Like, teams hang around, and then the last little bit of the fourth, they get absolutely throttled when they're the road team, even if you think they're the better team. We even saw that with, like, Golden State and Memphis. And Golden State's a pretty clearly the better club here. And yet, when they're in Memphis, it's like the Memphis Grizzlies just close so hard in the fourth quarter. And we're seeing it in the NHL, too. Like, I wonder if we're seeing so many blowouts, in part because we had this frame of time where there weren't crowds. There wasn't that, like, energy. I wonder if players are just not as accustomed to dealing with those emotional swings. And as a result, like, you're seeing blowouts one way or the other. If things are going bad against you and the energy in the building changes, it feels like it snowballs, and vice versa. If things are going your way, it feels like you're blowing the team out. You're not just stopping at three goals, you're adding five. You're not just stopping at a 4-1 lead over the Florida Panthers, you're making it seven. I sort of wonder to what extent the absence and then the prompt return of crowds has impacted the playoffs in both sports that I'm watching. Like, I wonder if home ice advantage, and it's not that the home teams are always winning in hockey, because in hockey you can also get the nervous crowd, right? We've seen that in Vancouver. Where a goal goes against you early and the crowd, but I wonder how much the impact of the crowd is having, and if it's been larger than in past seasons. Theoretically, like, just as a theory I've been kicking over watching these games across both sports, I sort of wonder if, you know, the absence of the crowd noise and then its return has sort of impacted this playoff run more than I would have expected going into it.
Well, since we're here, let's get into some of the playoffs, and we'll get to Kuzmenko in our final segment. So if you're waiting for Canucks, you will get more. It is interesting for me, basketball. It's been so home court driven, and the reason for that is the officiating and how the crowd impacts the officiating and how the crowd impacts teams to be hyper aggressive to draw the calls that they get. But then you look at what's happening in that Bucks-Milwaukee series, and yeah, there was a bad call on a three-point attempt that should have been a three-point shooting foul in the last game, but they called it a two-shot foul from the floor. But when you look at what happened at the end of that game, Boston got 17 free throws in Milwaukee. They got the final 17 free throws in the fourth quarter. Milwaukee didn't get any. And that just doesn't happen at home. It's such a departure from how games are decided, because generally teams just get more aggressive. They drive and they get that call because the fans are right on top of the officiating. And studies have shown this in the NBA, that you get more calls at home than you do on the road. But then looking at that game, it happened completely differently. But then the home team wound up winning it anyway. The one thing that's always impressed me with hockey playoffs is momentum doesn't exist. It just doesn't.
Game to game,
it simply doesn't happen. And you look at a team and they're so impressive. You look at these two series involving Edmonton and Toronto, and the winning team has looked so impressive each time out. You think they've got it figured out and they're going to roll the rest of the way.
Yeah. And the next game, it simply doesn't happen.
It's completely flipped, right? And I mean, I always say you can only win one game on any given night. Like, no matter how bad things go for you, you can only lose one game on any given night, too.
Well, and it's not Champions League, right? It's not aggregate.
Right. And it would be fun if it was, by the way.
As Kevin Bieksa coined way back in 2014.
Yeah.
When Calgary smacked the Canucks in one game.
Right. So, I always almost think, like, especially this rule especially applies for me in games 3 and games 5, which to me are sort of those crucial hinge games within a series. I almost think you're better off getting blown out because you know you get a response in the do or die game, the next one. You know, like, I always think, like, I watching Florida just get their asses kicked on Saturday. And it's, 7-1. They just could not break. That's a pretty inexperienced coaching staff, right? And there's some really smart people on it. But, Andrew Brunette, Derek McKenzie, Tomo Rutu, and Ulf Samuelson, right? I mean, there's not a ton of, like, coaching playoff experience on that bench. And they're trying to break down this sort of 1-3-1 neutral zone forecheck that the Caps install just to trap it up and prevent them from playing their five-man game. And they kind of stop playing the game that's in front of them. This is my hardcore Panthers analysis for everybody. And yet, they're down 2-1. I'm not saying the Caps aren't going to get this done or can't get this done. They certainly can, especially now that they're playing their better goaltender. But I won't be stunned if that's the last game the Panthers lose in this series. And I almost think the fact that they got blown out makes me feel more confident about how they're going to play tonight. Like, that they're going to come out tonight, and whether they win or lose, it's hockey, it can be random, they're going to put together an outrageous performance. Like, I would expect a high octane performance from that team. So, I almost sort of think there's games where you get blown out and I'm like, okay, well, that's almost a better result than having grinded and played well and dominated play and gotten your heart broken in a squeaker. Right. There's situations like that over the course of the playoffs, too, that I sort of keep in mind pretty closely.
Yeah. See, for me, I've never felt that in the NHL. Like, I've always been so impressed with the mental resilience of players. Right. I mean, you look at that Pittsburgh game, mm-hmm. to go to triple overtime and win should gut New York. And it didn't. Yeah.
No.
And that happens over and over. You see the most gutting result. And you're right that, yeah, it's easier to respond after getting blown out, but teams respond regardless. Like, that's the best part of this. And while we haven't seen a lot of close, compelling games outside of a couple of overtimes, we are seeing deep series across the board, right? I mean, other than the Avalanche and Predators, right? Like, all of these series could go pretty deep.
Yeah, I don't think all of them will, but yeah, I mean, it's setting up to be a pretty interesting week of hockey, which is a ton of fun. One quick note on the Rangers Penguins thing, right? Like, the Rangers lose, they're down to their third, or the Penguins are down to their third goalie, right? Louis Domingue.
How good of a story is that?
Awesome. Just awesome. And by the way,
does he still bake cookies?
I'm sure he does. Spicy pork cookies. These little appearances by goaltenders, like, they extend careers. Like, this is unbelievable for Louis Domingue. This will extend his career. He might earn another one-way contract out of this, or another couple one-way contracts. Like, you remember Danny Sabourin coming in and making 10 saves in relief of Luongo? Like, I know for sure that he thinks that if Luongo doesn't have to, go, that his career would have ended sooner. Instead, he ends up getting a couple more deals. Like, it was probably, it was a brief bathroom break for Luongo, but it was probably worth multiple millions of dollars to Sabourin in terms of how he was viewed by the industry. Louis Domingue, same thing. Like, this is going to earn him $1 million, $2 million, $3 million dollars over the next 4 or 5 years because of how he's performed. You love to see it. Good for him.
Yeah, no question. I mean, like, the ultimate teammate and the guy that just appreciates every minute of what he's doing, there. Right?
Totally. And last thing on Domingue. The Penguins, this is the difference, right, between structure and not. Like, this is the difference, right? if the New York Rangers were down to their third goalie, this would be a four-game series. Period. Period.
Yeah, but you couldn't have predicted Domingue to do this, right? Like, if it had gone the other way, you would have looked at it and said, but, oh, wait a minute. Like, I mean, as if they were ever going to win with Lou Domingue as the goalie.
If it had gone the other way, though, I would, well, but I mean, we had Casey DeSmith in the series before, and I didn't have a ton of confidence in him, and I still picked the Penguins in six, right? Because, you know, I believe in the impact of goaltending. Like, here's the thing. You can win the cup with an average goaltender, but you can't win the cup with average goaltending. You know what
sure.
I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, I got you.
You get that distinction?
Yeah.
So,
player versus process, yeah.
I just think it's hard to predict who's going to get hot in the playoffs. Like, you never know. I mean, look at Vasilevsky versus Campbell. Like, has Vasilevsky been an edge for the Tampa Bay Lightning in that series? I don't think so.
No.
Like, they neither goalie has been good on a night they lost. Right?
Fair. Yeah, completely
so,
fair.
And that's kind of how it works. Now, would you rather have Vasilevsky for the next three games? For sure. But is it very possible that Campbell's better than Vasilevsky two of three nights, considering it's a three-game sample now? Yeah, it is. Totally. You have greats that have letdowns over small samples. You have nobodies who crush it over small samples. It's so unpredictable that that's not the edge. Like, that's an edge you want, but it's not the only, like, it's not enough to overcome being an inferior side and just flop the goaltending situations. If the Rangers were down to their third goaltender, it would be a sweep. If the Penguins are down to their third goaltender, I still like them. I still think they got a real shot to win. In fact, they're favored to win at the moment. So, well, they have the lead, but like, they're favored to win. So
what do we make of Calgary-Dallas?
But, well, I picked that to be a six gamer.
Okay,
I thought that would be close.
The goaltending and how you see this game and whether or not the ghosts from 2 years ago are playing in or whether or not Ottinger's going to steal it and Markstrom's been okay. Like, you know, what are we looking at in this series? Because you and I both felt the Dallas Stars were not a good hockey team.
Well, no, I still feel that. Let me
and
be
for
clear.
Everybody saying, you know, the Canucks never should have made it. Well, Dallas is not a good hockey team. And I've got the other side saying, oh, they're playoff built. They've got the best top line for playoffs and they know what they're doing. And I'm thinking, really? Like,
no, I don't buy that. I just think when you're playing in a low event series, right? When you're playing in a series that has what? 9 goals across 3 games. Well, it's pretty easy for a couple of those to go against you. Right? I mean, that's why, like, if you want to understand why talent wins in the NBA, and why in the NHL it's such a team level game, like, the way that I've always thought about it is, you know, in your average half of basketball, there's 90 shot events, 90, right? In the average full game of hockey, there's 60, right? So it's like 180 versus 60. So your talent in the NBA has 3 times the opportunity to impact, and it's probably more, but 3 times the opportunity to impact the final score, right? I mean, it's literally a volume shooting at the draft, volume shooting in terms of events. Your skill has more opportunity to impact the game and be decisive on the outcome of the game just by the nature of the sport. When you play a particularly low event series, Dallas and Calgary being sort of the most prime example in the playoffs, that means that you're more susceptible to the whims of the hockey gods, right? Like, one rebound goal against you in a 2-2 game in the third period and you're sunk, right? Like, there's not enough goal events for the Flames to insulate themselves against an inferior club. And so I still think they're going to win this series. I'm not doing the Calgary panic thing, but, you know, that's the risk you run playing Sutter hockey. Like, I do think that they are better suited to playing a higher octane team that comes at them a little more than they are playing their mirror image opponent in a Dallas Stars. And they're not a mirror image opponent because the Calgary Flames are materially better. It's just that the styles are similar in a way that causes it to be a sort of mucky affair, which is why I thought that the Dallas Stars, despite thinking just about nothing of them, especially the way they play under Bonus, you know, that's why I thought they were going to be a tough opponent. I expected this to be a long series, even at the outset, just because that's kind of how it works when both teams sort of agree to play in this kind of dull manner.
I think you're right on all counts on it, except I do think Ottinger might be getting into the heads of some of Calgary's top players, including
Ottinger's awesome.
But like you can tell that top line is squeezing the stick, their collective stick a little bit.
Yeah, but that's, you know, again, no game-to-game momentum. Like, will you be shocked if that line has a five-goal outburst
tonight? But it's been pretty much the entire series, has it not?
No, it has. But, I mean, I'm just saying that changes at the drop. It takes one weird bounce. You know, like I always remember the Alex Edler broken stick at the start of the second period of game three in Boston, right? The Canucks get the Aaron Rome major and they kill it off. And it's the start of the second period and right off the draw, Alex Edler goes to make a stick check and his stick breaks and the Bruins get, and it was like this moment where all of a sudden the floodgates broke open and this Boston team that had nothing going started to fly. That's all it takes. That's all it takes sometimes. You get that one fucking break, and it makes a huge difference.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we do want to get into Kuzmenko and a few other Canuck topics before we wrap up this episode of the VanCast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
So, Drancher, we talked earlier about the Canucks, also the Oilers. They've already met with Andrei Kuzmenko. There are other teams in this mix, including the Vegas Golden Knights. What sense are you getting from the Canucks' opportunities to land this player, who he is as a player, and how he could potentially change the trajectory? Not that he's going to all of a sudden make the Canucks a contender, but in terms of a value player coming in, a player that's 26 years old, ready to come in and make not an impact, but just play at a National Hockey League level right now, and what that could do to this lineup. Let's talk a bit about Kuzmenko and the possible fit here and the likelihood of the Canucks landing him.
Look, this would be a huge coup for the Canucks if you can land Kuzmenko. I mean, period. It's found money. Now, do I think Kuzmenko is a superstar player in year one? Probably not, but I don't think it's out of the question. Right? This is a guy.
Superstar player. Wow, that's big.
This is a guy at the age of 26. He sort of spiked in the KHL this year for SKA St. Petersburg. 53 points in 45 games. That makes him a pretty rare performer. Like, it's not common to be point per game plus at the age of 26. We haven't seen it that often. And when we have seen it, typically, the player has, you know, at least played NHL games. So the two guys who I could find that were proper comps for Andrei Kuzmenko in his age 26 season. The first one is a really intriguing name that people may remember. He was probably on that list of guys who, you know, should have got another shot. But this is, I'll start with the bad news comp for Canucks fans. Stefan DaCosta. Okay, so Stefan DaCosta, you remember he was like a highly, there was a big competition to get him signed out of Merrimack, where he was, you know, dominant for a couple of years, and he ended up going to the Ottawa Senators. He's a French-born player. And in his age 26 season for Moscow, he didn't play the whole year, but we're talking about a guy who was, you know, a 20 point and 24 game guy. This is one of those classic, like, in the new NHL, you feel like he might have had a very different career than he did when he, you know, broke in and just played a couple years for the Senators before heading over to Europe. But that's one of the comps. So that's your sort of bad news comp. Your good news comp, however, is Alexander Radulov. And these are the only two that I could find based on my rubric, right? Based on my, like, offhand way of looking at it. This is how I do player comps. I look at size, Radulov's 6'1", Stefan DaCosta's 5'11", so Kuzmenko's 5'11", so I'm looking for guys in and about that range, roughly the same weight, same age, same league. How did they fare? Radulov's the other comp. In his age 26 season, he was point per game, 34 points in 34 games. Now, the year before, he was 20 points over point per game, and the next year, he was 25, so It was sort of a down year. He had some injuries that season. It was like the Olympic year. But nonetheless, Radulov's a real comp for Kuzmenko. And, you know, Radulov came over to the NHL in his age, like came back to the NHL to sign with the Montreal Canadiens in his age 29 season. And over the next 3 years had, you know, 200 points, like 200 points in the league over the next 3 years. That's a really good player. Like, that's a really good player. I think there's, you know, I don't think Kuzmenko is Radulov, but I think there's a level just underneath that that he could maybe hit. And if you can get that player without spending an asset on an entry-level deal, nonetheless, for next season, I mean, that's huge. That's huge. And then from Kuzmenko's end, a lot of this is about opportunity because you have to work on an entry-level contract for next year, but you're setting yourself up for a big payday the year after. You can't do that if you're not getting minutes, right? Like, you need to be getting minutes. If the Canucks are able to land Kuzmenko, I think they have to move some of their glut of wingers, top six wingers in particular. I think that would be a crucial part of what the Canucks are pitching too. Like, come play for us and you'll get, you know, a massive opportunity with a good center. And
do they really have a glut of top six wingers?
I think so. I mean, Garland, Miller, Besser.
Yeah, but it clarifies what you could then do with Miller. Like, you could leave him in the middle, which Boudreaux clearly likes doing.
Yeah, you could.
Right.
If you've decided you could play him
in the middle, you could, you know, you've got Besser and you've got Garland. And, you know, and then after that, you could keep Podkolzin, you know, as a pretty good play driver on a third line.
Yeah. And we may see that approach, but I mean, Kuzmenko would be a coup for this organizational end, particularly because there's so many hands in the pot, so many people pitching here. But I mean, Vancouver would be a tremendous get for the Canucks if they're able to land the player. And I think there's a real chance that he's, you know, useful. I sort of threw around superstar. I'm not saying he's a superstar player, but do I think he could be a top six guy? I do. Like, I really do think there's reason to believe that he could be a top six caliber contributor next season.
What are his timelines? Because there were three other teams that he was reportedly talking to in the coming days after getting the Canucks and Oilers out of the way.
Yeah, one would think that we're still a couple of weeks out, and then I would also expect there to be some complications from the immigration process. It's really tough to get work visas anyway post-pandemic, but it's extra tough to get work visas for people coming out of a belligerent country that's at war at the moment, which Russia is. So, you know, I do think there's a fair bit of work to be done there. And could that be a disadvantage, not just for the Canucks, but also for the Edmonton Oilers through this process? You know, I'm sure Kuzmenko's camp hopes not, but the Vasily Podkolzin experience is still fresh in my mind. And that took, you know, 4 or 5 months to get it done. And that was before the war. So we'll see.
But I think the decision making. Friedman reported Vegas, Carolina, and Nashville among the other teams that he's had meetings with. And those three teams he's already met with.
So I mean, we'll see. I just wonder about the Canadian factor and if the immigration thing disadvantages the Canadian teams that are, you know, in the bidding process. That would be something that I'd be sort of watchful of as sort of a invisible hand factor that could prove decisive down the line here.
So we're just about to wrap things up here. When are we doing our next live room? You want to do that later this week?
Yeah, I'm down. Let's, do you want to do like a post game? Do you want to do like a post playoff game? One?
We could do it maybe after the next after game six of Leafs and of Leafs Tampa,
and then it would
but
be
I don't want to make
like,
our show about that game.
Yeah, well, also then it would be Troy Stetcher live watch.
Love
good
it
for him, eh? Good
love
for him.
It.
Scored yeah, you a know goal. What? The play it on is. The empty netter was awesome. Troy Stetcher coming in clutch. They should have played him earlier. You know, this is one of those guys, like, everyone draws it up on their whiteboard and tries to keep him out of the lineup, but he's just so sharp. He's just so smart, so competitive, and such an effective defensive player. He's always going to get his way into the lineup, and once he's there, he's going to hold on. Like, he's one of those guys. Tremendous loss for the Canucks.
Well, given the salary, absolutely, right? I mean, he could be a regular in Vancouver's right side tomorrow, and no, I know that they felt they needed to move on from him. So
he'd be their best right-handed defenseman or their second best right-handed defenseman, period.
Yeah, I look, you're not going to get an argument from me. And I understand why they wanted to move on. They felt that that's an area we have to upgrade on. And, you know, that there were limitations, but they didn't. And to me, when you look at him, it's just the sum is so much greater than the whole of its parts, right? Like, he's just always effective. And to see him play alongside Alex Edler, boy, we've seen that movie before, and that worked out well for him.
Oh, he's the perfect guy to play with Edler. If you have, like, a, you know, relatively immobile defensive focused defenseman and want to pair him with a guy on a third pair, like, Troy Stetcher's your guy. Troy Stetcher's your fit. So, no, I love to see it. That's what it comes down to. I love to see him do well, and thought he played brilliantly for the Kings on Sunday. And that Kings team, they're hanging tough. A lot of people didn't give them a chance. I thought they'd win. We'll see.
You talk about goaltending, like, Quick has been so up and down. Because if you saw the way he played at the end of the year, you would have thought playoff Quick was back after quite an absence. But now he's showing why that absence has been there. Like, you know,
I'd be playing Cal Peterson.
Would you?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, regardless, when they've won, Quick has been exceptional. And when they've lost, Quick has been meh.
Yep.
And no question. Oilers can make you meh. But just the way, the way he's been playing, but also, I think LA's been doing a really good job against Edmonton's power play in those wins, right? I mean, Edmonton had opportunities last night, and I thought their penalty kill was really good.
Yeah, they're a good two-way team, and an imposing opponent to, like, that's a measuring stick opponent that the Canucks have to be mindful of, because this Kings team, they're going to control the trade market to the extent that they want to in the years ahead. They have, you know, rebuilt better. And they are better today than the Canucks are. You know, that's the team you're chasing. Because by the time this team is ready, 2-3 years down the line, like, that's the team that's going to be ascendant in the West, in the Pacific. So, you know, I'm not being alarmist. I think you have to keep, you know, a side eye on the Kings if you're Vancouver in terms of charting what's next for your club. Like, that's the team. It's not about closing the gap with Vegas, who's, you know, 2 years from now, like, most of their best players are gonna be 32, with the exception of Shea Theodore and, you know, Jack Eichel. You know, that I'm not saying they're not a threat down the line, they are, but that's not the primary sort of concern for me. It's not the Calgary Flames either. It's really going to be the Kings. The Kings are the measuring stick team, the team Vancouver is chasing, even if you know, even if right now, anyway, they're not seen as this Pacific juggernaut.
Well, they're going to have their next crack at it in a couple of nights here. That series sitting at 2-2, and the Kings certainly look good. They were full value from start to finish. They owned the first period. Edmonton wasn't able to tilt the ice at all in the third period. The Kings were absolute full value. And quite frankly, if Smith didn't play the way he did early, it would have been over earlier. So, but hey, what does that mean? It means nothing in these playoffs, because momentum doesn't matter game to game. Edmonton going back home can turn it on just as quickly. As for us, hey, if you're looking for more podcast options, Ian Mendez has the Athletic Hockey Show. He'll have a full recap of a busy weekend of playoff hockey in the NHL on Monday. And as for us, thanks for listening to the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. Right now, you can get annual subscriptions to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. Stay on our social media, because we'll let you know exactly when we're going to go. But right now the plan is to go Wednesday. We'll just figure out what time and whether or not we do a live room. So we'll keep you updated on all of that as the week progresses. For Drancer, I'm Farhan. Thanks for logging on.